This is The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, sitting in for Tanzina Vega. I normally host the United States of Anxiety on WNYC, Sunday evenings in New York, and its podcast as well. But I will be with you today as Tanzina gets a break. So thanks for joining us.
America's story depends not on any one of us, not on some of us, but on all of us, on we the people. That's the task before us.
It's the first full day in office for President Joe Biden. Yesterday, in one of his very first actions, he sent immigration reform legislation to Congress. The bill marks a sharp turn in the conversation about immigration in the Capitol. It includes an 8-year timeline to grant citizenship to roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States. It also allocates billions of dollars in funding to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, part of a plan to improve some of the conditions that lead many migrants to leave their countries in the first place.
The U.S. Citizenship Act modernizes our immigration system. It provides hardworking people who have enriched our communities and lived here for decades an opportunity to earn citizenship.
Newly installed Press Secretary Jen Psaki talked about the bill at her first press conference yesterday.
The president's priority reflected in the bill are to responsibly manage the border, keep families together, grow our economy, address the root causes of migration from Central America.
It's a notable change after 4 years of hardline immigration policies from the Trump administration. And although some immigration advocates have criticized the 8-year path to citizenship as longer than they had hoped for, a number of advocacy groups have expressed their support. Meanwhile, prominent congressional Republicans were quick to criticize the legislation. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley and Florida Senator Marco Rubio have both called the proposal a non-starter. That's quote. Senator Rubio, notably, was part of the bipartisan group of senators who led the last meaningful immigration reform debate in Congress back in 2013. And with Democrats' slim majority in the Senate, getting an immigration overhaul done under President Biden will require support from the GOP. Here with me now to discuss is Elora Mukherjee, professor and director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. Thanks for being here, Elora.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
And also with us is Dara Lind, a reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica. Welcome to the show, Dara.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me on.
So it's maybe a shame to start with the politics and maneuvering of this, Dara, but you know it is obviously going to face a huge hurdle in Congress. And so it's in some ways surprising that President Biden chose to lead with this fight. Why is he prioritizing immigration reform right off the bat?
So it's actually an open question to what extent he is even prioritizing immigration reform. Mm. You know, obviously, there's a difference between having bill text ready to go on day one and sending the message to Congress that this is the thing I want you to do first. And he's not doing that. It's been very clear that both President Biden and Democrats in Congress want to do COVID relief first. And even that, they have said, you know, they may not get a bill on his desk until March. So the question really is, is this bill that was introduced yesterday something that they want to happen immediately after COVID relief, which no one has said explicitly? Is it something they want to happen after COVID relief and climate change? Where does this fit on the legislative agenda? And frankly, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday, you know, listed his priorities for the coming term, mentioned a few things, didn't mention immigration among those key priorities. So there really is an open question, you know. The Biden administration is sure treating this as something more than just kind of a messaging bill or a vision bill, but how much political capital they actually want to spend on it is really not clear right now.
It's interesting because it seems like a very serious bill. But as you've said, I mean, in previous rounds of this, this would be the whole year's worth of legislative calendar to deal with it. But let's talk about the bill itself. In any case, I mentioned the 8-year pathway to citizenship for immigrants without legal status. What would this actually look like in practice?
So, you know, when people say an 8-year path to citizenship, that's, you know, from the date of enactment and would, for that matter, include any immigrant who's in the country as of January 1st of this year, which is a pretty generous, you know, that's not obviously the only requirement, but it's a pretty generous cutoff point and would go to the point where they would be allowed to apply for citizenship. That's not only shorter than past attempts at legalization have been, but it actually allows them to spend only 3 years after getting green cards to apply for citizenship, which shortens the time for immigrants under current law. That's a 5-year period at minimum. So it's a very, I mean, it sounds like a long time, but it's a very expedited path. And then it's further expedited for people who currently have deferred action, who currently have DACA, or people who currently have TPS, under the logic that they have already been living in the U.S., able to work legally, that they have been, you know, they are already kind of in the system in a certain extent, have been vetted, et cetera. It's a fairly progressive attempt at a legalization program by that standard.
Right. And Elora, as somebody who has worked directly with asylum seekers and refugees, what stands out most for you in the proposed bill?
Right. So what stands out most for me is what the administration has done in the past 24 hours. And in the past 24 hours, what we've seen is a welcome break from the unrelenting racism and xenophobia of the past 4 years. Just to put the past 24 hours in context, I want to mention that during the Trump years, we saw about 900 executive actions that changed immigration law and policy that were designed to inflict pain and terror on immigrant families and communities. And while this, it's remarkable that this legislation was introduced on day one. And in addition to the legislation, what we've seen over the past 24 hours is 7 executive actions designed to bring the United States back into compliance with both domestic law and international law obligations. So what that includes is, first, the repeal of the Muslim ban and the African ban, and a requirement that the Department of State restart visa processing. Second, we're seeing a pause on deportations for 100 days to allow the Department of Homeland Security to reassess its priorities for who should be caught up in the immigration detention system. Third, we see an executive order that's designed to protect Dreamers. Fourth, an executive order that halts the construction of the border wall. Another executive order stops the processing of people into Migrant Protection Protocols, a farcically named program that requires tens of thousands of asylum seekers to remain in Mexico, often in squalid conditions in refugee camps. Sixth, what we saw is an executive order designed to ensure a fair and complete census that counts all people in every state. And finally, we saw an executive order blocking the deportation of Liberians. So whereas during the Trump years, cruelty was immigration policy, it seems that the Biden administration is committed to making the most out of this opportunity to build a fair, humane, and functional immigration system. And there's a lot to be done through executive action, even if the legislative piece of this is more difficult.
Can I just ask you, because you mentioned you ticked through those quickly on the lifting of the ban, the travel ban, what does that actually mean in terms of the lives of some of the folks who have been impacted by that ban?
Right. So the Muslim ban and the African ban are two untold stories of family separations during the Trump years. What this has what these bans have resulted in is thousands and thousands of families unable to reunite because of religious discrimination and national origin discrimination and racism. And what the lifting of these bans does is requires the Department of State to again process visas for the countries that are affected by these bans. And this raises the potential for thousands of fiancés and spouses to reunite with each other, for mothers to reunite with their children, for students from these countries to pursue their dreams of higher education in the United States. This is life-changing for many people affected by these bans.
Dara, going back to the bill itself, you know, so the Democratic Party approach to immigration reform has for a long time been this idea that they would trade ramped up enforcement at the border for pathways to citizenship. This bill seems like an effort at that bargain again. So what's on the enforcement side in it?
It's so it's not actually. This is really the defining feature of this bill and why there's been so much enthusiasm from the immigrant rights community about it is the Biden administration, instead of, you know, and this is kind of the flip side of what we were talking about earlier about the questions about its path to passage. Like, the reason that it's not at all clear what the, you know, how you can get 10 Senate Republicans on board if you need, you know, if you weren't planning to go the reconciliation route, or how, you know, how you can get this through the Congress, is that it doesn't have the kind of major enforcement trade-offs that we're used to seeing. What they're doing instead is treating this as an opportunity to, you know, take a regional approach, which is something that President Biden was very interested in as a vice president, something that the Democratic Party has really come around on, to, you know, border management instead of border security, and including a lot of
I think we've lost Dara a bit there.
American countries. So it's the question, of course, is how can you, if you needed to get any votes, how would you add Republicans to that bill? And you know, like if you had to add enforcement to the bill to get Republican votes, would you lose the Democrats and advocates who are so enthusiastic about it now?
Right. And then in terms of the other, are there any other differences sort of in the from the Obama approach in this? You tick through a couple of those, but what else would stand out for you about how this is a big shift from how the Obama administration handled it?
Honestly, when Obama came into office in 2009, their first priority was making it clear to Republicans they were serious about enforcement in order to pass a bill. Instead, with Biden, we have this rapid scaling back of enforcement on day one. So there does appear to be a demand to Republicans to meet Democrats where they are rather than the vice versa.
Right. So that it's not being drawn in one direction or the other, or it's not being drawn to the right as soon as the negotiation begins, which has been sort of the critique of immigration reform for all of these years. And it would not, just very quickly, it would not take effect. The people under who have been in the states since January 1st are the only people who would apply. Correct, Dara?
Yes. But I mean, if this were to somehow pass and get the president's signature, which is not clear.
And Elora, you've witnessed some of the unsanitary conditions for migrant children detained in Texas for weeks by Customs and Border Protection under the Trump administration. Are there steps by the Biden administration that are coming or that we've seen that can make sure that what those children went through doesn't happen again?
I don't have personal inside or knowledge about changes related to the Flores Settlement Agreement, which protects the safety and well-being of children in federal immigration custody. But what I expect is at least minimal compliance with that settlement agreement, whereas what we saw during the Trump years was abject ignoring of the settlement agreement itself. Our country should be treating children with basic humanity and dignity and respect when they're coming into the United States, and I expect that the Biden administration will adhere to those basic minimum standards.
And what about COVID? How do you think COVID has impacted all of this? You know, this has come up when we talk about detention in general, but how do you think it's impacted asylum seekers and refugees?
Right. So the impact of COVID has been that asylum seekers have basically been blocked from entering the United States at the southern border. And there are, inside immigration detention facilities, very dangerous conditions for immigrants detained there. In the words of one federal judge, detention centers holding parents and children are on fire with COVID, is what she ruled over the summer. And what this means for asylum seekers and refugees is that there needs to be put into place systems for allowing asylum seekers and refugees into the country that take public health concerns into account. And there are ways to do this. We can imagine a system that would require asylum seekers and refugees to be tested for COVID before entering the United States, to quarantine for 14 days to make sure that they don't show any symptoms during that period and then to be let into the United States. There are ways for the United States to meet its obligations under domestic law and international law while safely processing asylum seekers and refugees into our country.
And Dara, Laura mentioned earlier the remain in Mexico policy that the Trump administration had. Remind us what this is, and is it now completely gone under Biden?
So the remain in Mexico policy took people who were coming to the U.S. to seek asylum and said, we're not telling you no, but you're going to have to wait in Mexico until we allow you to come into the U.S. for your court hearing. And then after you have your court hearings, if your case isn't resolved, we'll send you back. And so that's resulted in, you know, some 20,000 people being in Mexico while ostensibly having legal proceedings in the U.S. That was put on pause for COVID, and the people who already had court hearings scheduled have now had those deferred kind of indefinitely. The Biden administration last night said that as of today, they are going to stop putting any new people into that program. But as Laura was saying, because the current policy is that you just get pushed back if you come into the U.S. anyway, it wasn't exactly the main way that asylum seekers were getting treated anyway. So we can expect that this isn't going to resume after, you know, the kind of current COVID policy of expulsion ends, given what happened last night. But at the same time, it's not at all clear what the timeline is for the people who theoretically are now in the are already in the program and have court hearings. And furthermore, the Biden administration said last night when it announced that it was going to stop new enrollments in the program, it went out of its way to point out that even under President Biden's immigration bill, people who aren't physically present in the United States right now wouldn't be eligible for legalization. So it did explicitly tell these people who are waiting in Mexico that because they were put into the Remain in Mexico program under the Trump administration, the Biden administration will not put them on the path to citizenship.
Yeah, so it remains an issue. And Laura, we have just a couple of minutes left, but, you know, one of the big parts of this bill was that there's going to be resources for addressing sources of migration in the first place. What would you tick through a couple of the top things you would like to see happen in that regard?
Right. So as most of your listeners know, the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are plagued by immense and horrific gang violence that leads many, many people to flee from those nations. Those nations are also affected by climate change, which has led to the inability of many people to engage in sustainable farming and have sufficient food to have a livelihood for themselves and their families. And so what a regional system for managing migration would include is real direct supports to the governments of those countries to build safe and secure systems where people can live fulfilling, thriving lives and they don't feel the need to migrate. So that would include supports for non-governmental organizations. It would include supports for education, healthcare, and the supports needed in the home countries so people don't feel in danger of their lives and the need to flee.
We'll have to leave it there. Ilora Mukherjee is a professor and director of Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law. And Dara Lind is a reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica. Thanks to you both for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday afternoon, Joe Biden became the first president in U.S. history to denounce white supremacy in an inaugural address on the same Capitol steps that were overrun by a violent white mob just 2 weeks before.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
As he did on the campaign trail, President Biden used this first speech as president to remind people of how race and racism have shaped the U.S. and the very nature of our democracy. U.S. democracy has never been for all people throughout our history and even into the present. Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color have been shut out from full participation on everything from voting to housing to education. But as racial justice movements have grown, we've also never heard a president use that massive bully pulpit to make a sustained argument for why a multiracial society with shared opportunity is good for everybody in the country. We've so rarely heard the affirmative case. So will Joe Biden and Kamala Harris finally be the ones to make that argument a centerpiece of their administration? To consider that question and more, we're joined now by Cheryl Cashin, professor at Georgetown University, contributing editor to Politico magazine, and author of the forthcoming book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Cheryl, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So can we start with the premise that I just offered there? I mean, do you agree with this idea that, I mean, we've all been reminded of the remarkable power of the presidential pulpit in shaping the American conversation all the way down to our dinner tables, right, in the Trump era. But I don't think I can say I've ever seen a president use it to make a sustained affirmative case for pluralism in America. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I have never seen it. And I'm a political junkie and I come from a civil rights family and I've been involved in politics, served in the Clinton administration for 3 years, watched presidents constrained by American politics evade discussing race, racism, white supremacy. And here we have Joe Biden, who ran and centered racial justice. You know, when he announced, he said, you know, his battle for the soul of America, this language that was in every major speech he made. You know, he talked about watching what happened in Charlottesville, and that's really what motivated him to run. Yeah. And at bottom, it was a plea for unity of purpose across boundaries of race. So yes, it's a watershed. And it wasn't just language. You know, I'm a policy wonk, and I spent time reading Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's platform, and I had never seen before such deep specifics of how they were going to address racial inequity and racial justice and the racial wealth gap. So it was refreshing and something new.
And, you know, but I do also don't want to dismiss the language part, because I just wonder about this making the argument for the idea that pluralism and a multiracial society is good for everybody. I mean, what is your measure of President Biden and his ability to do that? I mean, so if he has said, OK, that's what he's going to do, what is your measure of his ability to actually do it over the coming years?
Well, let's stick with language for a second, and let's stick with the idea. In order to get policy done, you do have to build a political majority for what you're trying to do. So he was going through education and, you know, refreshingly talking about our history. So that's the beginning of setting the precedent for new and inclusive policies. But he was also arguing for this basic radical idea, and it reminds me of the radical Republicans of Reconstruction, that people of all colors in this country deserve to be participants in democracy, not just as voters, but also to run for office and be fully actualized citizens that shape policy that bring all people along. So I think he was speaking to political aspirants, and let's be honest, every politician in this country who runs for statewide or national office faces a basic architecture of American politics. A solid majority of whites tends to vote Republican, and a solid majority of people of color, Asian Americans, Latinx, Native American, Black people, tend to vote Democratic. And every politician has to choose, you know, how to deal with that basic architecture. So Biden was speaking to a lot of people of color to get them to be enthusiastic to vote for him.
A significant shift for the Democrats.
Right. And you know, so some of it was, I'm not being cynical about it, but some of it was, he had to compete for those votes, right? He wanted people to be enthusiastic. So it's not just about pluralism for bringing all people along, it's pluralism for allowing people of all backgrounds to be real included participants in this beautiful American project called democracy.
In just a few seconds we've got before we have to go to break, what about his past?
Well, what about it? You know, I mean, the fact that he has to overcome a past of skepticism is part of what made him compete hard, right? Mm. Compete hard to prove to people of color that he meant it, right? That he, and you know, so, you know, I'm a forgiving person. You know, I was open to being convinced, and I think many other people were too.
Perhaps he's got the zeal of a convert. I'm thinking about your book and your book subtitle, and I want to ask you, you meant it, the subtitle includes the phrase opportunity hoarding. What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Opportunity hoarding is in-group sanctioned processes that have the effect of excluding out-groups. In-group sanctioned processes that have the effect of excluding out-groups. So, you know, having high stakes tests for the best and most prized high schools in New York City. The people who know about those tests and prepare for them forever and have the money to get tutors for them, you know, they sanction that as merit. And people who don't have resources or aren't in the know about them are excluded. That's just one example. But, you know, I'm not here to promote a book, and that book won't come out till next September, though. So,
well, I just think it's an interesting idea, particularly in this conversation, you know, because it feels like one of the challenges, right, is getting people to understand that if new rights for somebody else doesn't mean less for me. So getting white people specifically to understand that. And I wonder about what you think the Biden administration, either in policy or but also in this sort of messaging and in this using the bully pulpit, needs to do to move to challenge that thought process.
Well, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head, right? In post-civil rights America, we had 5 decades of dog whistling where Democrats and Republicans did it, but the Republicans Party realigned the South from the Democrats to the Republicans on a lot of messaging that stoked fear and resentment about people who were allegedly getting ahead of them, right? You know, starting, well, I don't want to get into the long history, but, you know, Reagan's welfare queen, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the refreshing thing, if you look at the coalition that Biden has built, the coalition that in Georgia, the new Democratic senators from Georgia, heavily on the work of Stacey Abrams and many, many women, Black women in particular, they have built what is referred to by political scientists as ascendant coalitions, critical mass of whites who like diversity, or at least open to it, don't fear it, and want to be part of a coalition with people of color to pursue saner, inclusive policies that bring all people along, the opposite of opportunity hoarding, right? And, you know, there are, not all white people are the same. You know, and I use the term culturally dexterous, right? Some people are more dexterous than others. What is cultural dexterity? At bottom, it's the ability to accept the loss of centrality of whiteness in politics, in culture, you know, in demographics, without fear, right? And even potentially seeing the assets of that, even potentially loving across lines. Right. And I think that there is a growing swath of culturally dexterous white who's open to this new and diverse America. And Biden has done a wonderful job of speaking to those folks.
Well, and part of that speaking to those folks might be his unity message that has been such a central part of his political life, certainly this campaign and certainly his inauguration. But that also for some folks in the racial justice space and Black people in general, and those of us who feel like we were harmed in some way by the Trump era and the centrality of white supremacy in it, hear that and also think, oh goodness, you know, you're telling we got to unify with people who with insurrectionists. How does that part of his message fit into this project?
Well, I think a lot of voters of all colors were pragmatic in voting for Biden. Frankly, living under Trump as president was just exhausting for everyone. Exhausting and dangerous, right? So I think there are a lot of people who, particularly very left-leaning progressives of color and Black people, who Biden was not their first candidate, right? But they were willing to, you know, give him a chance. And you know, a lot of people just wanted to get Trump out and begin something different. Now that flank is going to hold him accountable. You know, he spoke of racial justice and racial equity. He beautifully invoked the language of Langston Hughes and MLK in saying, you know, the dream of justice will no longer be deferred. And they'll try to hold him accountable. But I think it was a pragmatic decision. And I think a lot of people appreciated that Biden could bring some white independents and white working class people to the fold. You know, it's a big tent.
What in our last bit here, what is that accountability going to look like, you think? We have such a groundswell of activism, and particularly around racial justice over the past year. Where does that energy go now?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, one thing that's nice is we have accountability built into the system in terms of the plethora of people of color who are represented, who serve in Congress. You know, Jim Clyburn, who saved Biden's in many ways, you know, is going to hold him accountable, right? People, I think Kamala Harris and Susan Rice and this, you know, wonderfully diverse cabinet, you know, these folks, he's nominated the most diverse cabinet in American history. Half of them are people of color, right? Yeah. So there's representation built into the system, built into Congress. But then, you know, I encourage people who are skeptical about Biden or who want to see him deliver, just to keep up the pressure in terms of all of the ways that people do. Calling up your congressman or holding press conferences or, you know, using Twitter, using voice.
We'll have to stop there. Cheryl Cashin is professor at Georgetown University and contributing editor to Politico magazine. Thanks for joining us, Cheryl.
Thanks for having me.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jerry Seinfeld on making a life in comedy.
This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. Any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Jerry Seinfeld on his film Unfrosted and more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, in for Tanzina Vega.
All my colleagues I serve with in the House and the Senate up here, we all understand the world is watching all of us today. So here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again. Not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges.
That was, of course, President Joe Biden yesterday speaking during his inauguration. And his olive branch to the traditional allies of the United States stands in stark contrast to the inaugural address 4 years ago when Donald Trump made his nationalist pledge to put America first. Joining me now to talk about the global relationships that need repairing and how President Biden plans to approach this is Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post. Ishan, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be with you.
So what alliances exactly is Biden talking about here?
Well, first and foremost, we're obviously looking across the Atlantic at Europe. As you pointed out, President Trump came into office 4 years ago and really upset the apple cart. He looked at alliance systems like NATO, the world's most important military alliance. He looked at the European Union as a strategic bloc that was a competitor to the United States, as opposed to how Biden and successive American presidents have seen it, which is as a force amplifier for American interests on the world stage. And he really really led to a lot of jitteriness in Europe. And so now Europe is a key component now in terms of how Biden will address the world. He wants to show you at the U.S.'s allies there, as well as in Asia and elsewhere, that America is back and happy to lead in a more conciliatory, humble fashion than what Trump posed.
What about beyond Europe and China? We hear a lot about those places, but what about South and Central America, for instance? I'm wondering about how the mess Trump left behind there has affected those countries. Take Venezuela, for instance.
Well, this is where there may be a degree of continuity as opposed to radical change. Mm. You're not going to see a very left-leaning Biden administration in this instance. They're going to maintain a pretty hostile front toward, say, Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. You may see them try to restart the thaw that had begun with Cuba under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. But in many of these arenas, the Trump administration has kind of boxed in Biden and his allies. And any moves to take a softer approach on these putative adversaries in Latin America is going to be read as too soft and as weak in Washington. So it's setting the stage for a lot of domestic angst. But in general, I think the major departure that we may see when it comes to the Western Hemisphere is first, Biden has already signaled that he wants to face Central America and recognize that the root causes of migration can be addressed in Central America as opposed to by building this physical barrier on the America southern border. And then he may really have to have a showdown with far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who really counted Trump as a very close friend and who will probably be Biden's climate enemy number one when it comes to thinking through collaborative measures on climate change.
Ishan, as Biden said, the world was watching. What are we actually hearing from global leaders so far?
I think there's a genuine degree of relief, especially as we were talking about in Europe. Biden is a known entity. He's somebody who can be more predictable, who can offer a degree of reassurance when it comes to thorny shared geopolitical challenges. But at the same time, I do think Biden himself and a number of prominent lawmakers in Congress have overstated the degree to which the rest of the world needs America to be this example. There's this kind of belief here, especially in Washington, that America is, in everyone else's eyes, a shining city on the hill. That has not been the case, of course, not in the past few months, but for some time before. And the rest of the world has experienced this past half decade, beginning with the rise of Trumpism, as they've seen it not necessarily as an aberration, which is how it's being cast by some here in Washington, but as a reflection of where American democracy is and where American politics is. And it's not necessarily a good place. They see the dysfunction, the division, the unleashing of populist passions, and America's adversaries, say China, They view the situation as evidence of the failures of the American system.
Do you think that the Biden administration is trying, you know, do you think they understand that and say, okay, well, we need to lead into a different world in which we're not quite the leadership that we were? Are they trying to reverse that?
I think there's, you heard future Secretary of State Tony Blinken specifically point to the need for humility on the world stage in his prepared remarks during his confirmation hearings. And that probably is an ethic that was completely absent when you have someone like Mike Pompeo talking about swagger. I think there is a recognition that the United States is no longer this kind of hyperpower, hyper superpower that it once was, and that it doesn't need to be. But at the same time, Biden himself said that, you know, we've been tested and we've come out stronger. And I think when you talk to a lot of folks abroad, they see that they're not placing much stock in the belief that the U.S. has necessarily come out stronger.
In our last moment here, what are you watching in terms of first big moves?
Well, we've seen with these executive orders, Biden already signal a return to major international organizations like the WHO and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. What I'm interested to see is there has been talk about him leading a new kind of geopolitical bloc of democracies, like-minded democracies, and that would be the vehicle through which he addresses a lot of challenges from climate change to reckoning with the rise and potential threats posed by China. So we'll see in the next few months whether that kind of alliance of democracies takes shape and what role the U.S. plays in shaping it.
Ishan Tharoor is a foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post. Ishan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for being with us this week and me today. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a voice memo recorded on your phone to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. The show is on Twitter @TheTakeaway, and I am there as well. Shoot me a note at Kai_Wright. Quick shout out to the crew that makes this show. Lee Hill is our EP. Polly Urungu is our digital editor. Alexandra Boti and Amber Hall are our senior producers. Our producer crew is Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Patricia Jacob, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Our board operators were Sham Sundra and Vince Fairchild. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Kai Wright, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.